Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. With each new generation, the older ones look back and wonder about those kids today. Imagine parents when their kids started listening to Elvis and the Beatles, then disco, grunge, alternative rap, hip-hop. When kids became glued to TV sets, then handheld computer games, desktop computers, and then their cell phones. And art went from classic paintings to modern art to street art. So how does one generation understand the next? And even more importantly, how does the next generation convey what they're thinking, feeling, and experiencing? Over the past 2+ years, there's been a project afoot here in Vermont to find a way for young people in the state to express what they're going through. It's called the Listen Up Project, and we have 3 people involved with it, and they'll be with us this hour to discuss where it is, what it is, how you can experience it. Sadie Chamberlain is a cast member of Listen Up. Sadie, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Bess O'Brien is the directing producer. Bess, great to have you here today.
Great to be with you, Rick.
And Isaac Eddy is the director of the Listen Up Project. Isaac, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick, thanks a lot for having me back. It's great to be on the show and great to hear your voice again.
Excellent. Now, listeners, if you want to ask our guests about Listen Up, you can call us 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Bess O'Brien, where did the idea for the Listen Up Project originate from?
Well, actually, Rick, I did a project similar to this about 16 years ago. It was called the Voices Project, and it was the same thing. It was an original musical based on the lives of Vermont teens, and the idea was to delve deep into the world of teenagehood and bring those voices forward and educate, frankly, the state of Vermont about what was going on with young people. And the Voices Project was an incredible revelatory experience, I think, for a lot of people to learn about the day-to-day lives of teenagers. And it was an incredible project. People may know me primarily for being a filmmaker, but actually my background is in theater. So about every 10 or 15 years, I try to do a big theater project to get my feet wet again into the theater world. And so essentially, I did that 16 years ago, and then a couple of years ago after my last documentary film, I was thinking, what am I going to do next? And I was sort of missing theater, and I thought, why not do the Voices Project again these many years later, call it the Listen Up Project, and see what the tenor of youth, their voices and their lives are like right now. So we actually launched this project in 2019 at the State House with the governor and many of the kids who were originally involved with the project. And we were originally supposed to tour the show this past fall. And, wow, of course, COVID happened, and everything had to be stopped and canceled. And so we are now touring the Listen Up Project this August, outdoors under the stars, and we're thrilled to finally be bringing it to everyone.
Sadie, how did you first hear about the project?
So going on 3 years ago now, I got an email on my phone from Bess O'Brien, who I had not heard of, and it said, "We want you." So I was like, "Bess, what do you want?" The concept of Listen Up was explained to me, and I was actually recommended through the mother of one of my friends at my local theater troupe, and it was so intriguing. I was like, oh my gosh, yes, please. I would love to be a writer for this project. So I began on the writing advisory board, and then later this spring, I got the opportunity to audition, and I was asked to be part of the cast, and here I am.
Oh, Sadie, that's so cool. Why was this something you really wanted to be part of, both roles that you have been as part of the Listen Up Project?
You know, I think I really wanted to be part of this project because not only did I want to tell elements of my life story in the Listen Up Project, but I was so anxious to hear other people's stories, and Listen Up does such a great job of portraying teenage life from all different perspectives, whether it's from race, from gender identity, from economic background. We cover the whole gamut, and, you know, being able to help other people tell their stories and seeing part of my story portrayed is just a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm. Isaac, when and how did you get involved in Listen Up?
I've been talking with Bess for a couple years. At first, it was just as an advisor. I was in conversation with her and with some of the teenagers in the writing team to help them devise different ideas for the script through improv and through other elements of stage acting. But then I also reviewed some of the interviews as well and helped think about the bigger framing of the show in and of itself. And then I was very happy to get the invite from Bess to be signed on as co-director.
And once you kind of saw what was going on, why did you really want to be part of what was happening here with Listen Up?
Well, I've been talking a lot about this project since we started rehearsal, and it's really, I feel like it's a culmination of my kind of creative and artistic, it's the highest thing that I've wanted to do in my whole creative life. You know, as you know, I was a Blue Man,
yeah.
Blue Man Group for 12 years. And then I've been teaching theater and directing theater at NBU Johnson for the last 6 years. But this project itself is something that really calls on all aspects of my kind of goals as an artist. And that is working with young folks, putting up beautiful and experimental theater for many different communities, and most importantly, creating the work in the same room in a multidisciplinary fashion. So there's not one single author. We are representing many voices, and we are creating that story through the process is creating that story with many voices as well.
Bess, I love that, you know, you are doing this, the next generation, which means we're going to have to, you and I will be talking about this in 15 years in your next Listen Up type project or Voices project. But how, two things, how logistically is this different, you know, the way you went about doing this as opposed to doing the Voices project? And what's the difference in what you're hearing from the teens of on this project than you did 15 years ago?
Well, first of all, I'll definitely let Sadie jump in on what teens are talking about so you can hear it from the horse's mouth, per
right.
se.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the difference primarily is that this is much more immersive than the Voices project in the creative aspects of it. Isaac can talk about devised theater. But really, you know, so much of the work that I like to do from the documentary filmmaking point of view or when I work in theater is from a documentary anthropological sort of sense of going to the source and then creating art from that. So we certainly did that with the Voices project, but this project goes even deeper because we're really continuing to hone the script, the music, the choreography, and even some of the directing with the actual company of teenagers that are here now. So the layers of input on this particular project are probably deeper than the Voices project was. The other thing is for the Voices project, I also directed the show, and just because I'm older and I've got a lot more to do in my life right now with getting this thing up and running, I am very happy to have given over the reins of directing to Isaac Lowry and Sarah Lowry and Isaac Eddy. But I think that, you know, the difference is between now and then is that we're in, frankly, a very different world than we were in 15, 16 years ago.
Right.
And that the urgency that I felt when we started talking to teenagers 2.5 years ago through a series of interviews and roundtable discussions across the state was that, you know, it is time to listen up because teenagers are in a place right now where the world is not necessarily an easy place to be in for many, many reasons.
Yeah.
And they're feeling that they have to step up, and that's, you know, that's both awesome, But it's also, I think, somewhat of a feeling of where are the adults in this situation? Like, you know, whether it's climate change or gun control or just mental health issues or just whatever is happening. I think certainly COVID was a whole other layer that we had to deal with. We thought the script was sort of done, and then COVID happened, and we had to go back to teens and talk about how COVID has impacted them. So we're in an intense period of time right now in 2021, and so it's a different tenor than the Voices Project. But Sadie, what do you think?
So, you know, the Listen Up Project, it's been really fun to create because Beth is very much right. We live in a very different world than it was 15 years ago. Granted, I was very little then, but even still, you know, we live in a time where so much information is being thrust at us. And in that information is a sense of urgency, a sense of do it right now, a sense of we need you to save the world. And that's, you know, and when you're young and have a lot of gusto, that can be inspiring. But with the wealth of tragedy and polarization and confusion and this kind of general social reckoning that's happening, it's beautiful, but it's stressful when you're still trying to navigate college and getting a job and maintaining a stable family life and just your general identity. How can we conquer this ever-changing world while still acknowledging that we are right on the precipice of adulthood? And Listen Up does a very good job of addressing all of that with humor and reference.
Nice. Isaac, over 800 teenagers, you know, were interviewed, gave input. So how do you take all of those messages and concerns, the challenges, turn that into a production, a musical, that will be up and running and touring in a couple weeks?
That is the main question, right?
Yeah,
is how
right.
How do we distill all of these stories and all of these kind of intersections of identity into a single show that doesn't flatten and simplify the complications and the stories of all of these Vermont teenagers. Instead, shows the stories within the complexities, right? And it's not easy to do. And yet we have a script that that does just that. It tells stories from all of these different perspectives and identities based on race, socioeconomic class, sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression. And we're able to kind of put it together. We're able to find commonalities when there are commonalities to celebrate. And also we're able to kind of sit in the uncomfortability of our differences. And it's a long process of in the rehearsal process as well. And we didn't just give them their lines and put them on the stage and block it and choreograph it. These are Vermont teenagers who are representing these stories on stage as well. And if we didn't honor their own identities on stage, then we were not only doing a disservice to them, but we weren't honoring the kind of mission of the musical in the first place.
And Bess, you have to kind of build the structure to make this thing happen. And you know, a lot of people don't see that kind of behind the scenes coordination that takes place. So how do you go from 0 to 100 pretty quickly, you know, in getting advisors together, getting reaching out to students and finding out, you know, what they have to say, and then putting this project together? Of course, facing the big roadblock right in the middle of COVID, but how does that coordination get all put together?
Well, it's a massive, massive, huge project. And I have to acknowledge, first of all, our major donors and underwriters, because without them, none of this could happen, because you need money to make something like this happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, right now we're at Lyndon Institute. There's 26 teenagers and 10 to 15 adults all being housed and fed. You know, we've got trucks and buses and, you know, sets and lights and stages that need to be schlepped. And, you know, it's doing theater alone, if you were just doing The Sound of Music, would be a big lift. But doing this project that you're really creating something from nothing, you're starting at the very root of the issue and building up, is very, you know, it's a huge lift. But that's exciting for me because I find it invigorating and truthful. I mean, I think that, you know, what I'm interested in as an artist is going to the truth of whatever I might be talking about, whether it's making a film on opiate addiction or doing a show called The Listen Up Project. It's like, who are the voices and how can we make those voices authentic? And so, yes, it's, I also think everyone needs to like put their ego aside. I have an incredible group of artists who I'm working with who have all been extremely collaborative with each other. And so everyone has their role, but everyone listens very closely to everybody else and also obviously to the students. So it's going over and over. It's like editing a documentary. It's like, you know, I do 27 cuts of a film, you know. And so, you know, this is the same thing. It's, you know, going to the source and going to the next level, then having kids write the music, then having, you know, kids listen to the music, then having a music director look at the music. And, you know, it's layer upon layer upon layer. But that's just to simply say the donors for this project are the Vermont Department of Health. Huge kudos to them for seeing this as a major health initiative for young people. Blue Cross Blue Shield is a major underwriter. We also have support from Burton Snowboards, VSAC, the Alchemist Foundation, University of Vermont, and also many other individual donors who have supported my work over the years. So without their support, this could not happen. This is, you know, trying to keep something afloat for 2.5 years with all of these spinning plates takes cash. Yeah. And without that support, it could never have happened.
Sadie, you were already involved, but then when it comes time to put the production together, you've got to audition. So what was the audition process like to become part of Listen Up the Show?
So you had to present, I believe it was a minute monologue of anything you wanted. And then you also had to sing a minute of a song. And then if they liked that, they would call you back and they asked you in about 4 days from the time the email was sent if you could learn 30 seconds of another song and do some acting exercises. And if they liked you in that, then you get to be part of the Listen Up cast, which is a great privilege.
Wow.
Let me just say, Rick,
yeah,
that all this was done on Zoom, okay?
Yeah. Oh, yep. My gosh.
I mean, Isaac can talk about how many freaking Zoom meetings, like, you know, just writing the script on Zoom and finishing the music on Zoom and doing the auditions on Zoom and, you know, Lord have mercy.
The first script reading was on Zoom.
That's right.
Which was so weird because you really couldn't get a sense of who everyone was.
I did a Zoom call with friends last night. I can't imagine what you all gone through. Go ahead, Isaac.
No, I just wanted to say the last time I was on your show, I was talking about the piece that I created with my NBU Johnson students that was all on Zoom called The Monument. And, we created it and it was, we're very proud of it. But what's so great about this show is that we're back to doing theater face to face. And we did the first script reading on Zoom, and Sadie's right. There was, I could already tell that the actors were very talented and that the show was going to be amazing, but their Zoom has its limits. And it was so great to be like, guess what? We don't have to be stuck with these limits. We are soon going to be together to actually put the show on its feet, which was a very, very good feeling.
And I'm just going to chirp about this. This is testament, thank goodness, to Vermonters rolling up the sleeves and getting to whatever we are now at 83% vaccinated. So well done, Vermont. This is a knock-on effect you can see right here, right, Isaac, of what it means when people say, yes, this is the right thing to do.
Absolutely. I mean, we are so proud of our state for trusting science and for getting out there and getting vaccinated. And, you're right. I mean, the numbers, it is crucial right now with the Delta variant, and we're staying safe thanks to how many folks have been vaccinated.
Sadie, give us a little background of other productions that you've been a part of.
So I've been doing theater consistently since I was 5 years old. Wow. So I seldom remember a time where I didn't have some show to do. I did theater all through elementary school, after school in the evenings. And then in high school, I did the fall musical and all that cheesy stuff. And my sophomore year of high school, I got the privilege of doing competitive theater in the spring. And that just, it's a whole nother level because you're actually fighting to win something. And that sense of community and that sense of team is just so strong and alive. And it's just wonderful to be a part of.
That's excellent. Explain competitive theater for us.
So competitive theater is so all the states in New England do it. So you, from February to March-ish, you rehearse a one-act play, and you're timed. So setup, tear down, and performance are all supposed to be in 1 hour. So if you're smart, you should make sure your play runs no longer than 45 minutes and that your props are simple.
Oh, my. Wow. That has to be quite an interesting. Although I would imagine with this this production, we'll get into it in the next half hour about how much this is going to be moving around the state. You pretty much to take in those skills. We're learning about the Listen Up Project from our three guests. Listeners, to add to the discussion, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Coming up today at 1 o'clock on WDEV, we've got Equal Time with Travin. That's followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. An exciting project has been in the works for the past 2 years that allowed more than 800 Vermont teens to collaborate on a musical that will be performed around the state starting in just a few weeks. With me is cast member Sadie Chamberlain, directing producer Bess O'Brien, and director Isaac Eddy. Listeners, to ask questions about the Listen Up Project that we're talking about, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255 or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Isaac, as you start rehearsals, what kind of tweaks have you had to make to the script or to the music once you had that cast there?
So Beth mentioned the process of devised theater a few minutes ago, and that's how we are thinking of this project, where in devised theater, you create the script with the ensemble, and it's not a single author, it's an author of many, which best represents this project. Now, of course, we had a fully written script that was already collating all of the 800 interviews that were done and taking in the teenage writing group. But we knew that the final element was just as important, which was the ensemble that we were working with. And we wanted them to be able to honor the stories that are already existing in the script, but also to be able to add their own stories as well, because they were the ones, they were the bodies on stage representing these stories. And because we have such a diverse cast, we basically first opened up the conversation about identity and representation and intersectionality, so that they all were able to kind of get everything on the table about what they were comfortable with, what they were not comfortable with, what they were confused about, what language they thought didn't really fit for teenagers right now. Yeah. And also they talked about how they felt like they wanted to change some of the tone of the play to be geared more towards teenagers. They felt like some of the language in the play was meant to kind of handhold and educate parents, And they said, you know what, that there's obviously that's important, but we also want messaging for teenagers like us, because this is a show by us and for us.
Wow, Devise Theater. This will make Dave Sellers, the architect, very happy. It sounds a lot like the old design build movement that started here in Vermont in the 60s.
That's exactly right.
Right?
At Goddard, right?
Yeah, well, and then they did it up on Prickly Mountain here in Warren is where they were building these homes.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I grew up close to there. And you know what? I've talked about building theater like this in physical form before, but I've never put it directly to that movement. And it's very similar. That is so cool.
Oh, that's brilliant. Who composed the music?
It was, Bess, go for it.
Go ahead, Bess.
Before COVID, what we did is we put sort of a call for entries out to all the music departments in high schools and said, are you interested in helping to write music for an original musical? And so we got a number of teens who sent in audition reels of their work, and we chose, I think, 15 of them to collaborate with professional songwriters on the songs for the show. And our original concept was that we were going to have a couple of weekends where we would bring these teens together with some songwriting mentors, and they would write the music together. And, of course, that literally that weekend that we were all supposed, the first weekend we were supposed to get together was something like March 25th, 2020. So we all know that whatever it was, March 15th, that's when everything went down. So that got thrown out the window. So then we were like, how do we write this music? So we said, well, we're going to have to go on Zoom. And so it was extraordinary. Through March, through the summer, we broke into teams of like three or four teenagers per mentor. And they wrote together on Zoom the songs that are now in the show. And we continued into the fall. We didn't know how it was going to work. We didn't know, if people would be able to focus on Zoom. But this, I just remember, Isaac, you remember this, the first four songs that were written, and our music director at that time, Nate Vinette, who was overseeing it, played the first four songs, and we were like, oh, my God. I mean, that's when I'm, as a producer, I was like, oh, my God, this is so much work, and it's COVID, and what does it all mean, and why am I here, and existential this and existential that. And then I heard those four songs. I heard those four songs, and I was like, oh, now I know why we're doing this project. Wow. Right, Isaac?
Exactly. And this happens again and again and again. And even with Sadie giving her insight today, we give the agency to these teenage artists, and it affirms every single time why we're doing this. And it's incredibly inspirational, humbling, and it's just such a great project.
Sadie, have you been in a production where you've had this much input into the final product before?
Never. This is all new. Device Theater is a totally new concept for me. And, you know, as much as Isaac is giving me and the rest of the cast so much credit, I really got to toss it back to the direction team and the design team for letting us butt in despite our young years and, you know, giving our voice to every aspect from choreography to set design, and to be able to do that and be listened to with also knowing that we're not going to step on them is just a very powerful feeling, and it brings a lot of humility to the room.
Hmm. Well, Sadie, you're kind of in that in-between time. You know, rehearsals have started, so that initial excitement of getting together, seeing who you're working with, you know, that's passed. Now you're still a few weeks from the first live performance in front of an audience. So how is the cast and crew faring right now? You know, it can get to be a slog in the middle. How is it right now?
Oh, we are a chuggin'. It is far from a slog. It's hard work, it's tiring work, and when I go to bed, I go right to sleep. There's no Netflix, I just have to shut my eyes. It's that rigorous environment. But it's so wonderful because Tech is fast approaching. That's next week. Yeah. So this week is really about digging our heels in and saying, okay, we've stumbled through the show. Now let's make this tighter, cleaner, sharper.
Yeah.
And this group, I've never, honestly, I've never been in a group of thespians and actors and designers and dancers and everything who are so dedicated and focused and open-minded that the sky's the limit for how Listen Up is going to turn out. That's what I feel.
Isaac, yeah, with Devise Theater, you know, at what point do you say, okay, this is what we're going with? Because you want all that input. You know, this seems to be, you know, a kind of, you know, it's always changing. It's a bit, you know, part of the process is letting it morph. But at what point do you say, okay, we're there. Now we've got to learn it and get ready to put it on.
Yes, that's a great question. It's completely nerve-wracking because we don't have forever to do this, right? There's 3 weeks of rehearsal, and we want to ensure that there was time for just devising, not putting it on the stage. And I want to say to Beth, I'm so grateful that she trusts us in the direction team to be able to take that time, you know?
Yeah.
And thankfully, part of that is that I have a co-director. And Sarah Lowry is a drama therapist and is trained in a lot of ways of doing this type of work where you're mining your own experiences to put on stage, doing it safely and doing it ethically, essentially. And I have some training in that as an educator, but she's has much more background in it. And we just make an incredible team where sometimes I will be the one that's saying, oh, we got to move on. We got to get this. We got to get this on the stage. We have to stop this right now. And she looks to me and says, no, this is an important part of the process and us to be able to have that dialogue. And we're very open with the ensemble as well. You know, we're completely transparent about, what our plans are for the day, what our plans are for the week and when we think we need to move on. But it's a real, this is where my expertise is being able to see when you get the proper thread of what folks are talking about in the room, starting to stitch it together. That's what I love as a director, is seeing the commonalities in narratives and then seeing how to transition between all of these multiple different stories. And what has been great is we have developed a language with the ensemble where they have complete agency. There's a kind of a flat hierarchy where they are throwing in ideas for choreo, throwing in ideas for blocking and for character development and for lines. But there's also this kind of delicate time when they are allowing us as directors to kind of take the reins to put the final icing on this cake, you know? Yeah. And what I love though is, there's sometimes they don't like the icing and they feel comfortable bringing that up, with us, you know? And there's just an example that we, are doing a lot of blocking. We're not, a lot of the show is showing the kind of internal life of teenagers, meaning the blocking isn't meant to be naturalistic. The blocking is meant to be expressionistic to show these emotional landscapes of these characters, right? Mm-hmm. And so because of that, we didn't want to have literal props. But the teenagers, there's a lot of references to cell phones, obviously, and the teenagers didn't like miming cell phones, you know, and that got brought up a few times. And Lowry and I said, you know, this, we feel like this better fits the vision to not actually hold out these prop cell phones. But just yesterday with our designer, Trish Denton, we figured out a kind of nice compromise, which I hope the ensemble will appreciate as well, where we have these kind of cutout rectangles of bright color to represent this cell phone and our relationship to screens. And so there's a way that we are able to take their what they think is important for the show and keep it in line with our vision as well.
Bess, in arranging the scheduled performances, what were you looking at in the locations and the venues that you chose?
Well, first of all, one of the huge pivots that we had to make after COVID was that originally we had booked an entire tour across the state to 13 different towns indoors, starting at the Barry Opera House, ending at the Flynn Theater. And after COVID came down and everything changed and we were trying to figure out how to mount this show again, We all felt as a company that it would be safer to do the show outdoors because we really, you know, part of the thing with producing a huge project like this that I'm sure people don't understand, they don't need to, but is that you have to think 6 months ahead because everything has to be planned in advance, including booking places, including designing the set, including how you're going to stage the show. So this past January, we just felt like we didn't know what it was going to be like this summer. We did not feel like we wanted to take the chance of going indoors, and so we made the decision to go outdoors. So that was a huge change in because, of course, you know, you all of a sudden have to deal with weather, and you have to schlep a stage around with you from town to town. So be that as it may, making that decision also made it clear that we couldn't do as many actual towns or shows as we had originally planned. So we're doing 9 shows across Vermont, 2 in Lindenville, 2 in Norwich, 2 in Putney, 2 at Shelburne Museum, and ending up at the State House in Montpelier. So that's 9 shows instead of 13. I'm calling it the boutique tour. So if you want to see this show live and have the experience of a lifetime, get your tickets right now because it's going to be the seating is going to be somewhat limited. We want you to come. This is the time for you to see this show live. We will be filming the production and there will be a film version of it in the fall, but it's not going to be the same experience. Mm-hmm. So that's all just to say that, you know, each week that we are here is a huge challenge to get through. And by the end of the week, we all go, phew, we did it. Yeah. We're still safe. Nobody has COVID. We're moving forward. The kids are awesome. Things are still moving, you know, in the right direction. Next week, we move outdoors from rehearsing indoors. That's going to be a huge step in our process to get the entire cast assimilated to rehearsing outdoors. And then we're on the road. And we've got rain dates and we've got schlep dates and we've got, you know, that's going to be a whole nother experience. But right. It's going to be awesome. It's so Vermont. Bring your picnic blanket, bring your folding chair, sit out under the stars, listen to these amazing stories, this amazing music. And listen to our youth. Go to listenupbt.org, order your tickets. We're looking forward to seeing you.
Isaac, the schedule is pretty much 2 nights on, 1 night off, next town, do it all over again. Very ambitious, sounds like a Major League Baseball schedule. So how do you keep that cast and crew fresh and ready to go for each performance?
Well, I will say that I've worked with young folks in theater for 13 years now, and I typically have more energy and more focus, just a kind of a reserve higher than the ensemble I'm working with, and it's a great barometer that if I'm feeling tired, if I feel like I can't focus, then I know it's probably a problem with the ensemble itself. There's been multiple times in this rehearsal process for the very first time where I have started to lag because we're doing long hours every single day. Mm-hmm. And the ensemble is right there with me, fully focused, fully ready to go on to the next thing. You know, we're rehearsing this in a gym and the acoustics are tough. You know, there's a loud fan, there's humming lights. You would say you kind of try to speak to the whole ensemble and it bounces all over the place. Yeah. For a director, it's kind of a worst nightmare. You know, you could lose your voice really easily trying to just get everybody to pay attention. And these young actors are just, they're pros. I mean, they're here to do the work and they are listening to us. They're taking notes. They're giving their own insight, but they're always here to do the work. And I say all that to say, I just know that when we're on the road, they're going to be in it 100%, and I don't see any kind of problem in terms of keeping it fresh. It's going to be really exciting to be changing venues, and it's just going to be so exciting to do live theater together again. It's going to feel like almost like a religious experience, you know, to be communing like this again is just so special. And I did the Blue Man Show over 4,000 times, so I think they can do this show.
All right, that's a fair comparison. Sadie Chamberlain, you know, who do you hope comes out and sees the performances as you make your way across the state?
Anybody. And, of course, I want teens to be there because I want people my age and, you know, in my time of life to be able to see the Listen Up Project and be able to see themselves into some of the characters we have represented. But I want parents to be there. That's really important to me. I want adults, I want mentors to be there because, you know, when you reach a certain age, and unfortunately I'm starting to reach that age, don't tell the team, I'm starting to reach that age where, you know, you start getting in your own head and you start making up your own mind about things, and at some point that just stays stuck. And this is an opportunity for adults not to be stuck and to have their minds opened and their perspective shifted. So I want to see just as much youth as I do adults.
Yeah, to become unstuck. Is there a message, Sadie, that you hope people will take from the performances?
My message is, you know, adults need to step up. This isn't going to be a lecture. This is going to be a fun, immersive, educational experience. But, you know, just because we're 16 and you think we know everything, we still don't. We still need you adults around. But the other thing, and I think the most important message, is that Vermont isn't just rolling hills and farmers. It's indigenous people. It's people of diverse gender identities. It's future politicians. It's, you know, like, everybody is here in this brave little state. And, you know, I want young people with dreams and ambitions from all backgrounds and all ethnicities to be able to see this and see themselves encompassed in the story of a young person in Vermont.
Beautifully put. That's a message that we can send loud and clear to everyone, Sadie. Thank you so much. Sadie Chamberlain is a cast member of Listen Up. Bess O'Brien is the directing producer, and Isaac Eddy is the director of the Listen Up Project. To learn more, to purchase tickets, you can go to listenupvt.org. I want to thank all three of you for being on the program this morning.
Thank you so much for having us, Rick.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
It's a pleasure.
All right.
Thank you, Rick.
Take care now. All right. We'll head out for a few minutes and then get a CBS News update. After the news, we're going to hear about VITA's Vermont Agricultural Credit Corporation loan program. And a reminder that the Sox continue their series in Buffalo against the Blue Jays tonight. Our coverage begins at 6:07, first pitch at 7:07. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We know that agriculture is a massively important cog in the Vermont economy. Vermont's Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets reported that over 64,000 Vermonters are directly employed by over 11,500 farms and food-related businesses. But we also know that our farms, especially our dairy farms, face challenges that require them to adjust, diversify, or redefine themselves in order to carry on. So how are they able to do that? And where do they find the capital to make the changes needed? VITA, the Vermont Economic Development Authority, has a very specific program in place that we're going to learn about this morning. It's called the Vermont Agricultural Credit Corporation Loan Program. Joining me to discuss the details of the program is VITA's CEO, Cassie Palemas. Cassie, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. I am very happy to be here today.
It's great to have you. Listeners, if you've got a question about the loan program, how it operates, or if you've used the program, you want to tell us about it, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Cassie, can you give us a brief overview of what VEDA is?
Sure. Vermont Economic Development Authority is a statewide lender. So we provide loans to businesses and agricultural enterprises to help support the state's economic vitality and public policy goals. So, for instance, our various loan programs might help create jobs, support renewable energy, or help farms and foresters, all of which are very important to the Vermont economy. We have four offices throughout the state. We're headquartered in Montpelier, but we are statewide. We're not a private for-profit lender, so we're not like a traditional financial institution. We are created under state statute. So that makes us a little bit different, but we're also not an agency of the state.
So one of the programs that I mentioned that you offer that we're going to focus mostly on today is Vermont Agricultural Credit Corporation Loan Program. What is this program designed to do?
Yeah, so this program was created specifically to help the farming and forestry economy obtain credit that was, you know, not elsewhere available, say, through traditional lenders, to help farmers and foresters expand or achieve their business objectives. So, for example, it helps early beginning farmers. It can help farmers expand their existing businesses. It can help farmers acquire new machinery and equipment. You know, lately we're hearing a lot about agritourism. We can help with agritourism if that's a diversification strategy that a farmer is looking to get into, or other diversification strategies as well. So it's a very broad spectrum of, you know, sort of different programs that we can help farmers and foresters with.
And why is this, Cassie, something that VEDA offers and is needed here in the state?
Well, I think if you look at the history of farming, it has been, you know, farming is a little bit different than traditional, say, manufacturing or other businesses. It's specialized. You know, farmers have, there's a commodity nature to farming. There's a weather impact to farming. It makes it difficult for a lot of the traditional lenders to understand and want to take on certain types of risks, let's say, with the farming economy. So it's made it challenging for farmers to access credit through most of the traditional channels. So there hasn't been as much credit available in the traditional channels. So the Vermont legislature decided many years ago to create this program within VEDA to provide this access to capital for the farm and forest economy. And it's been tremendous. We've grown the program. It's been highly successful in helping the farmers and the farm economy and the forest economy have that access to capital, along with many of our partners. We work with the Farm Service Agency, specifically with who also provides direct loans as well as guarantees many of our loans. So it takes a certain expertise, really, to understand some of these specialized risks, if you will, with the farming economy. And that's what we provide. We've got that experience and we've got that in-house expertise with our staff.
Who are eligible for these specific loans?
For the VITA loan program, you need to be a Vermont resident. And for the agricultural loan specifically, you must be a farmer, which means that you derive the majority of your income from that farming operation. So growing or producing or processing, whatever that is, if it's dairy or berries or maple or growing fruit, orchard, you know, there's a whole vast array of agricultural and forestry industries out there.
And then what criteria is used to approve these agricultural loans?
It's really not unlike what you would expect if you were applying for, say, a residential mortgage. We would expect that the income from the business can support the loan. It's a little bit more complicated in that analyzing income from a business is a little more complicated than, say, analyzing income from a W-2 stub. But it's, you know, when you boil it all down, it's, you know, does the income, does the cash flow from the business generate enough to pay the loan? And so our analysis focuses on that cash flow. If it's an existing business, we're going to look at historically, has that business been able to generate enough income to support the loan that's being requested? Or if it's an expansion of that existing business, we'll ask for some projections to say, okay, the growth that you're expecting to get, will that support the loan? Or if it's a brand new startup, same kinds of questions. And then we get into a little bit more deeper analysis as things get a little bit more challenging. If you're starting a new business or if it's a beginning farmer, we will probably ask you to have a business plan with formal projections, and there's all kinds of technical assistance and help out there if you need it, say with the Farm Viability Program that's under the Vermont Housing Conservation Board. So we would, you know, we can certainly refer you to those sources to put together that kind of information. And then secondly, of course, we look at what kind of collateral is there for the loan. Mm-hmm. So if it's, you know, if it's a simple type of transaction, you're buying a new piece of equipment, typically we'll take that equipment as the collateral. If you're buying real estate, we'll take a mortgage on the real estate, those kinds of requirements, which are very standard.
What are the amounts and the terms of the loans in this agricultural program?
That will vary quite a bit. Generally, what our lenders do, and this is, again, standard in the industry, is to match the term of the loan to the type of transaction that it is. So if it's a real estate loan, let's say, it's a mortgage on the farm, that can be, you know, typically 15, 20, and in some rare cases, a little bit longer than 20 years. If it's a piece of equipment, it's going to be a lot shorter. It's going to match what the expected life is or a little bit less than that piece of equipment. If it's working capital, generally it's no longer than 3 years. Depending on what it's specifically used for. And then the rates are going to vary depending on, you know, how long it is and what the overall risk profile of that borrower is.
Gotcha. Cassie, you've mentioned that these agricultural loans can be used for farm ownership and farm operation. Let's split those apart. How can this funding be used for farm ownership?
If a farm, if a farmer would like to purchase a farm, they will need to take out a mortgage, just like if you want to buy a house. Mm-hmm. So it's really the same scenario. If you want to refinance the mortgage you have on your farm because you're doing an expansion or renovation, we would also roll that into the same farm ownership program. So we kind of call that the farm ownership, anything that's secured with the real estate kind of rolls into that farm ownership program, if you will. It's a broad category there that serves to say it's, you know, a loan that's secured with the mortgage and it's for purposes of acquiring or owning the underlying real estate with the farm and the farmhouse and the real estate that's associated with that. As opposed to the operating loan program, which is really for operating the farm. And so that can take on, you know, your working capital needs, you know, the machinery and equipment, purchasing livestock, all those other sort of broad needs of operating the farm.
Can you provide examples of farms that have received these agricultural loans and have expanded or diversified?
Oh, sure. I mean, since we've been doing this, farms have, across the time, either purchased a neighboring farm to expand their base or their operations, or used it to build an additional barn, let's say, or in some cases, complete diversification, changing from dairy to goat recently. You've been reading and hearing some about that. I'm sure our listeners are familiar with that. So it runs the gamut, if you will, as far as what you can do.
Last week we spoke to the Jang Farm up in the kingdom. They've switched from dairy to grain and in an operation. Talk about a complete pivot. In the course of a normal year, Cassie, how many of these agricultural loans does VITA tend to approve and for how much?
Well, it's cyclical, as you can imagine, Rick. Some years it's very, very busy, depending on the price of the commodities markets. So in 2017, it was very busy. You know, recently it has, the pandemic caused kind of a decline. So it was not quite as busy, although we did a number of PPP loans, paycheck protection loans, sure, for the ag community to help them through COVID. There were a number of years where our agricultural activity was busier than, say, our commercial activity, which is the other side of VITA.
Right.
Because we do a lot. The agricultural portfolio, it's, as I said at the beginning of the show, Rick, it's a niche. It's a specialty. It takes certain expertise, and there's a lot of relationship building. Our lenders really get to know and understand their borrowers and the farmers, and there's a lot of servicing. So if a farmer is encountering some difficulty, it could be, you know, too much rain, not enough rain, low milk prices. If they're, let's say, an orchard, they might have had a insect problem, whatever it is. We need to understand it, and we need to be able to help the farmer through that. So we provide a lot of servicing. And with that, there could be a lot of activity, a lot of loans, a lot of servicing in the form of deferrals. So it can be very, very busy, depending on what's going on in the overall economy, the overall weather, climate, commodity market. It's really very up and down.
Well, who's providing these agricultural loans, and what's VITA's role in that?
Besides VITA providing the
Are they coming directly from VITA, or is it someone else lending the money and VITA secures it?
Or directly from VITA.
Okay.
Yes. Yep.
All right. Yep. And then how is VITA funded?
So VITA is funded. We fund ourselves, basically. As I said, we are not a state agency.
Right.
So we do receive some support from the state of Vermont, but predominantly we have to go out and borrow our own money, just like a bank. You know, we borrow money from other larger lenders, and then we relend that money out to our borrowers.
Gotcha. Now, VITA also provides loans for agricultural energy projects. So mm-hmm. what do those entail?
So similar to non-agricultural energy, a farm can put a solar array on their property to generate renewable energy either for the farm itself or to, sell to the grid, to the energy companies, and receive a credit on their electric bill, just like consumers or other businesses can do that. And we see that with farms, you know, where you might see a solar array in a field, or you might see a solar on a rooftop. So we have, as I said, we have public policy initiatives, and that's one of them, is providing energy loan programs, both in our commercial side and in our agricultural side. And that includes solar as well as digesters, which we've done in the past. That hasn't been quite as active lately. They're a little bit more complicated.
Is VITA looking to assist early stage companies or those who, you know, are established looking to expand? Is there a combination you tried to find to do some of each?
Yeah, we do all of the above. So early stage, we support beginning farmers. The Farm Service Agency has a special program for beginning farmers that we work with. It provides an enhanced or a larger guarantee. And again, we would suggest working closely with Farm Viability for those beginning farmers. And we're seeing quite a bit of terrific activity in that sector, that particular area, which is quite encouraging, I think. On the other hand, existing farms are important as well. You may have had somebody else on the program talk about, you know, farms that, particularly in dairy farming, the consolidation that's going on and what that means to existing farms. And is there, you know, a need for management succession if there's a farm that needs to be, you know, the generational transfer, or maybe the next generation doesn't want to go into farming. So there are all kinds of issues out there that are, you know, important in continuing the farm economy. But, you know, there is this this movement that's been going on for a number of years now, where you see fewer dairy farms, but we have the same same number of cows, basically, and
right.
more milk being produced because we know how to produce it better. We're smart about how we're feeding cows. So there's a dynamic movement there, and it's figuring out how it's all going to shake out.
And Cassie, we have about 30 seconds left, but is Vita a secondary or last resort source for a business after they tried to get loans from a traditional bank or credit union?
No, we are not a last resort lender. We are a primary lender in the mm-hmm. agricultural sector because there just aren't that many. And so I would certainly encourage any farmer, forester, or anyone in the agricultural community to consider Vita. And I will just put out there, it's our website, vita.org. Email is info@vita.org. And our phone number is 802-828-5627. We are very happy to help.
Cassie Palemas is the CEO for the Vermont Economic Development Authority. And again, the website is vita.org, the email address info@vita.org, and the phone number 828-5627. Cassie, thanks so much for being on Vermont Viewpoint this morning.
Thank you, Rick. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great. Listeners, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to be back to open up the phones, give you a chance to chat. Don't forget the Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference coming up at noon today. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, and the phones are open until 11 this morning. If you've got something on your mind, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I've been off since Thursday, and I've been showing off Vermont to my sister and brother-in-law who came up from Reading, Pennsylvania. We had wonderful weather, of course, met wonderful people, wonderful food, and they were blown away by Vermont beers. It's very interesting when people come here and start drinking some of our beers, and there's just something we're doing up here, and it's not all the hopped up IPAs that we love so much, the Vermont style, but a lot of the others, the quality is incredible, and people notice it immediately. We put on 400 miles over the course of just a few days, and I figured it out. If they decide, if my sister and brother-in-law decide to join the Vermont 251 Club, conservatively, they've already checked off between 15 and 20 cities and towns that they've got a head start on. They're trying to figure out which of the ones we visited are their favorites right now. I'll talk more about my travels, but I'd love to hear where you take visitors from out of state when you have the opportunity, when they come here. What do you like to show off? There's no big Disneyland or Disney World, and that's kind of the one thing that people love about Vermont, but you do have to travel around, go to different spots. Let us know, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And, of course, with open phones, it's an open opportunity to discuss what you'd like. So please feel free. We're going to start off with Doug in Randolph. Morning, Doug. How you doing?
Good. Yourself?
I'm wonderful. What's going on?
I got a couple things I've been wondering about. One of them is the census.
Right.
I haven't heard much about that and what we're basing all these COVID numbers on. Are they old census or new census?
They should be new census, Doug, and I'll check on that. But I know census numbers did adjust, like the number of congressional seats in New York and Texas. So I'm pretty sure we now have new census numbers. Now, Doug, you bring up a very interesting point. It probably does not count the influx, you know, a lot of the influx of out-of-state people who have moved here over the last year, because we certainly saw that, right?
Right.
So that number could be, you know, a little low that we're basing it on. Excellent point, but let's see what we can find.
Okay.
All right, that's one.
Where did Peter Shumlin go?
Peter Shumlin, last I heard, was teaching at Harvard, not full-time, but doing some teaching there, and I believe back to the travel company that he and his brother own down in Putney. But, again, begs – you're asking great questions that I can only pretend I know the answers for to start off from. So, census numbers, what are we basing things on, especially the percentage of vaccinated – our numbers don't change too radically, so.
I wouldn't think so.
Yeah, but, it is a good question. I do think we'd probably be on the light side because of the influx, but we'll see what we can find there. And, where is Peter Shumlin? we gotta find out,
I'm curious there because, I've never really heard any resolution to this EB5 thing, and I think he's up to his neck in it. So,
well, again, you're right there. Although they have, I think, come up with some final kind of agreement with the main characters, Ariel Quiros and Bill Stenger. But as far as anyone in politics involved in it, no names, no
right.
Yeah. So let's see what we can find. If there's any, I bet that Anne
Galloway.
What's that?
Anne Galloway.
VT Digger will know, because Anne has been following this from the absolute start. She's the one. Remember, she like found that kind of thread that just kind of led to the unraveling, didn't she?
Right.
Yeah, they did great work, Anne Galloway and the crew from VT Digger on that whole EB5. All right, good things for homework assignments. I always love when I get them, so I appreciate it. Thanks, Doug.
Thank you.
All right, take care. All right, our numbers are 244-1777 and 877-291-8255. I will have tomorrow Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine on, so just thinking about that, Doug, maybe we'll have an answer as to how they are calculating the percentage of vaccines, what numbers they are using for the population of Vermont. So great. That gives me one question already that I can be asking tomorrow, and we'll see what's going on with Peter Shumlin. I'm not sure anyone in politics will be held complicit in that, just because they recruited people, which was under a federal program, unless they accepted money, and cut a side deal, that would definitely, be a reason for conviction. But I think with what happened in the end, is not necessarily going to be placed on the heads of anyone in politics. But we'll see. There could be more going on, and you bring up great questions, Doug. Okay, we're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. I mentioned that I was driving around the state last weekend, and I have to say it was absolutely stunning. We were supposed to have some rain. The sun came out for all the days that my guests were here, and Vermont looked absolutely beautiful. We went through East Hardwick. I got to see East Hardwick. You know, months ago we had two neighborhood community groups from East Hardwick on one morning because of the great things they're doing there. And I took a certain road out of Hardwick through East Hardwick to get to Greensboro. For the first time, I drove through East Hardwick, drove out through the northern side of Caspian, and oh my gosh, it was absolutely stunning. We were just having such a great time exploring new areas, and went over to Hill Farmstead. Now, Hill Farmstead's been voted best brewery in the world 5 or 6 times now. And I had to keep reminding my my guests as we were going there now, because we were in the middle of nowhere, right, which was wonderful. I kept saying, this is the one, this is the brewery that has been voted best brewery in the world 5 or 6 times. It's also very close to the Cheese Caves of Jasper Hill, which wins world recognition for some of its cheeses, right? Best in the world cheeses over here, and then 2 miles down the road, best brewery in the world. Anyway, Hill Farmstead now open Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. You can actually go in. They do have your wear a mask. Tasting room's not open, but you can now go in and order and pick things up. No growler fills, all cans and bottles. But we got there on Friday, say 11:30-ish, and it was – I should have played the lottery right then. There was no line. There were about 5 people in the place, which you remember at its height, you'd be waiting sometimes – on a Saturday morning, 2 or 3 hours, and we walked in and didn't have to spend too much time there. You can order ahead, which makes it easy just in case there is a line. Then you can just go and pick up what you've ordered and not have to wait so long. Anyway, Hill Farmstead, you know, really a Vermont treasure. And if you've got a day off right now, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, and you can get out there, now's a good time to strike and impress your friends with the beer you're bringing home. I realized as I was driving around the state from Thursday through Saturday, showing it off to family, I really want to go on vacation to Vermont. That's where I want to go on my next vacation. I want to spend some time at the Highland Lodge on Caspian Lake. I want to stay maybe at the Rabbit Hill Inn in Waterford, or stay in Stowe and shop and drink beer. That's all I want to do. There's a treehouse that you can rent on Isle Lamotte at the Turner Farmhouse. I want to stay there. Or maybe it's a B&B in Glover, specifically West Glover, so I can rush over to Parker Pie as often as I need to, which is often. What I'd really love to do, though, is pull a camper up or pitch a tent at Hill Farmstead for 3 or 4 days, but I'm pretty sure Sean Hill would have me removed after about a few hours. Where do you want a vacation in Vermont? Or where do you vacation in Vermont? I didn't even go far south. I did get down to Orwell, got as far south too as maybe Montpelier. So there's still so much of the state left to explore. Listeners, to join in, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. I do want to pass this along as you're dialing up and as I'm going to continue to talk about traveling around the state. Did get this from the Community Kitchen Academy, which we've had Chef Joey Buttendorf on a few times to talk about this. If you're looking to learn kitchen skills, chef, to become either a chef or someone who works in a kitchen, or just to improve yourself, this kitchen, Community Kitchen Academy is a wonderful program that goes on. They have one going on right now, and there's usually one held in Barrie and up in Burlington. The next one starts August 23rd, and then there's another one in October. Great time to apply right now. And here's where you can learn more. vtfoodbank.org/CKA. That's for Community Kitchen Academy. vtfoodbank.org/CKA. You can also call 249-6058. 249-6058. So check it out if you're considering, a career in the culinary, arts. It's a great way to get started. All right, we're going to head to Essex. Steve is on the line. Steve, what do you got for me?
If you want to visit a unique place, go to Plymouth, Vermont.
Oh, yeah.
The birthplace of Calvin Coolidge.
Yes, indeed.
We would need this guy back again real bad.
Yeah, so...
He was a president that we won't have again.
No, it's so true. Silent Cal. Tell people what they'll find when they stop in at the homestead there, because it's really quite elaborate, quite wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I hope people here and visit the place.
Yeah, I hope so too. There's a great visitor center, right, Steve? You'll see some of the homes of the Coolidge family and the cheese manufacturing cheese plant that his father owned, and then I think it was his son. Calvin was not in the cheese business, but it's been resurrected. Plymouth Cheese Company, which is in operation today, right, is right there.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, wonderful place. Great suggestion. Go ahead, Steve.
Andy Vitas. Remember the room where he met all the dignitaries?
Oh, yes. Yep. Yeah.
Well, have a nice day.
All right. Thanks for that suggestion. You know, Steve in Essex brings up a great one. I wasn't, I didn't get down that far. And Plymouth Notch down there in kind of south central Vermont, a really great trip to make. And again, once you're there, there's so many other places you can visit in that area, but Plymouth is definitely worth the drive. You could spend a day, you know, just getting to know Calvin Coolidge and that homestead. Love that suggestion. That's fantastic, Steve. All right, we love that. All right, our numbers are 244-1777-877 291-8255. I took family to Stowe. I took my family to Montpelier to see the State House. Over to Barrie for the Hope Cemetery, which was amazing. You know, every time I go, I'm just stunned. And I don't even think I've walked around that entire cemetery. I usually get about a third of it done, and then I think I've seen enough. It's just wild and wonderful what our stonecutters have created there. All right, back to the phones. We're going to Waterbury to talk to John. Hi, John. Go right ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can very well.
Okay. Couple of spots. The Breadloaf campus in east of Middlebury on 125.
Yep.
I find it breathtaking. And the other spot down in Dummerston, Kipling's home and carriage house are actually available for rent.
That's so, right. No, it starts with an N. What's it called again? All right. Well,
I'm sorry?
The name of Kipling's home.
Nakala, I think.
We'll look it up. All right. Two great suggestions. First of all, up at Breadloaf, right, you can take some wonderful walks, and this is a wonderful place, great views, and it's a lovely place. And then down in Dummerston, what was the home of Kipling for a few years, Kipling said, John, his two favorite places on earth were Bombay and Brattleboro, which I love so much, right?
Yeah.
But the home in Dummerston can be rented. You can rent the main home. You can rent the, carriage home, which became the servants' quarters. And once a year, and this already happened this year, I think it was in June, there are open tours, but it's not open for touring any other time of the year, right? But I want to get all my family and friends to rent that home sometime down there in Dummerston.
Yeah.
Oh, great suggestion.
November to April is the rates are a little bit better.
Okay. All right, I'll remember that. Thanks so much, John.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Yeah, Kipling's home in Dummerston. Let's see. Nalaka. Naulaka, Naulaka. What a beautiful, it looks almost like a ship. He had it designed and built. He lived other places in his life, but this was something that he himself did kind of design and build. He didn't build it, but had it built, and it is absolutely stunning. And we forget so many times. I'm glad John mentioned Breadloaf and Naulaka down in Dummerston. Yeah, we forget some of the marvelous places. Think of Hildene, the Lincoln family home down in Manchester is just one more fabulous place to take guests when they get here, and, of course, Shelburne Museum. All right, Danny, we're going to shut it down. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan, produced by Rachel Connor, Zoe Helena, and Brady Jalili. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Please feel free to suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. Then we've got the Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference coming up at noon. I'm Rick Sagary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.